let's go down on this Friday night and say hello to Superman, now in residence in Las Vegas. Hello, Johnny. Welcome back.
Oh, that's really cute that you called me Superman, because, you know, the world is getting darker politically. The country's getting darker politically.
Yes,
so I bought myself a beautiful black dark sweater with a Superman logo on it.
And that's terrific.
It looks fantastic. Anyway, the last 2 days, I play every afternoon. As you know, I play 9 holes of golf, and I stop.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of an Australian restaurant chain called Outback?
Yes, Steakhouse.
Yeah, Steakhouse. Well, I have one just down the street, and after I play 9 holes, I stop there every afternoon to get a filet mignon, a baked potato, and bring something home for 3. And the last 2 nights, wearing this black Superman sweater with the logo, somebody spotted me, didn't notify me, and bought my dinner.
Oh.
2 nights in a row.
Wow. That's nice.
Well, it is nice.
See, that's the kind of respect, John, that's the kind of respect that most of us will never see in this life. that's class. It's good for people, good for you.
They recognize me for some reason. And, you know, the only living in Las Vegas, the only thing people talk about is money. And one of my closest friends that tells me every day he's putting more into his 401k and asks me, am I putting more into my 401k? And I said, I have never in my life given a hoot about money in any way whatsoever. I said, I'm more interested in what goes into my films, not what goes into my bank account.
Uh-huh.
So, anyway, I am, as usual, sublimely content, not happy. I don't even know what happiness feels like. I don't know what sadness feels like. But I am always mostly sublimely content, and I think one of the reasons for that is I am the only person I know that has absolutely no beliefs. There you go.
Hey, well, listen, you're at peace, okay? There's no conflict. That's right. You are at peace.
That's exactly right. I am, and I just love talking to you.
Well, you're very blessed in many ways, and I'm really happy you're out on the links, 9 holes. I couldn't make it 9 holes, I don't think, but good job. Are you able to hit the green regularly still?
Yeah, I'm quite a good golfer, but I only play 9 holes. Listen, if I am not physically or mentally active, and I have to be active in both departments, I would just absolutely shrivel up. And my mind never rests. My body never seems to rest. And I must tell you, I don't know anybody who is as contented with his life or her life as I am.
I don't know that I've ever heard that spoken by anyone else. Maybe they think it, but I've never heard it. You know, I keep, whenever we talk, for some reason, sometimes Red Fox jokes pop into my head. I don't know why. You knew Red so well. He was your best friend, I guess, in many ways, for a long time.
He was my only show business friend for the entire life of his career and his life.
Wow. Well, you picked a great one, or he picked a great, well, however you want to look at it. When I was a little kid, junior high school age, we used to get Red Fox records. There must have been 100 of them. I don't know how many.
Yes,
they were just Red doing his stand-up or his sit-down in a club. And they put him on an LP. And,
yes,
my God,
did.
They were funny. Oh, they were funny.
Yes,
and
they were
nice, some of them. The one I just popped into my head, he said, man, I can't do it like Red did. Maybe you could, but man went to the doctor, and he said, doctor, I'm having a problem. Sex is just not fulfilling for me anymore like it used to be, and I'm worried. I'm paraphrasing here, but I'm concerned. And doctor looked at him and said, okay. And he said, well, when did you begin to first notice this, that sex was no longer rewarding and you had no interest in it? And the guy looked at the doctor and he says, well, 5 times last night and 3 times this morning. That's a Red Fox joke.
It is. It absolutely is. Both he and Jackie Mason were really, really, really close friends of mine. And they were the comics who could ad-lib the funniest of any comics in the country. Now, you have heard this joke. It was an ad-lib. I didn't know, even know where it came from. Because I did a number of shows with Red Fox. I must have done 15 or 20 shows with Red Fox. And then this on this one show, Jack Carter was another comic. And then there was a crying comedian was on. I forget who that was. And I asked Red when he was talking about being rich and being poor. And he said he never cared anything about, he only cared about money, because that's a place where you, if you had the money, you could buy the place where they hold the meetings, okay? So I happened to say to him very casually, why do you think money was colored green? And without missing a beat, he said, oh, that's because Jews picked it before it got ripe.
That's really hysterical. That's
it
funny.
It is. It is so brilliant, and it's so funny.
Yeah.
And Jack Carter fell off of his, literally fell off the chair. You can watch the video. And then he reached into his pocket and pulled out a $20 bill and started repeating it. It was one of the biggest laughs I have ever seen. And it was
I got it. Yeah. Well, that's a mind who does comedy. Now, you are guilty of giving this planet probably as many or more laughs than any other comic. Well, I can't say that, but you're right up in the top few. And that's a great gift to give the planet. You've made people laugh, and that's so difficult to do now. What they call comedy now, John, I don't see any real laughter in it. I see automatic responses, people laughing on cue when the punchline is delivered, but there's no humor in it. I don't see any funny aspect to what they call stand-up comedy today. These Gen Z people are idiots. There's no humor there.
Who was, I hope his name doesn't slip my mind, the greatest writer of Broadway comedies. God, what was his, Neil Simon?
Yeah, sounds right.
Neil Simon, okay, the Sunshine Boys and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
He called me, I did this album called It's Tough to Be White, in 1966, and I got a phone call from Neil Simon, who said that he had to pull off the freeway and park to listen to the rest of the album. He was laughing so hard. That's one of the greatest compliments that I ever had.
Oh, he said, if
you're going to do another comedy album, which you should, can I write the liner notes? And I thought, oh, my God, that would be absolutely wonderful. Well, I wasn't planning on it. But I got such a lot of reaction from the public, mostly the public and even some people in the business, over my film reviews, because there was always a funny line in the reviews. And so I thought, you know what? I'm going to take these and I'm going to put them into an album. So I did an album made up of funny stuff from my movie reviews. That's all that's in the album. It's very funny. It's called I Met a Man I Didn't Like. And that's a takeoff on, who was it, Mark Twain, who said, I never met a man I didn't like. Well, mine was the reverse of that. And Not only did Neil Simon do liner notes on it, but Burt Reynolds and Joan Rivers and a couple of other people who were major, major stars in the business, they heard the album, they called and they said, can I put notes on the back of it? So if you happen to get the album, which is still topical and funny, and you turn to the back side, you'll see 8 or 10 of the most famous people in Hollywood writing positive comments about it.
Well, I've seen the cover. Didn't you just put the cover up on your Facebook page recently?
Yes, I did. I don't know if I did the other one. I met a man I didn't like, and then the other one was It's Tough to Be White.
That's the
one. And I said if I were doing that again in 2025, I wouldn't call it It's Tough to Be White. I'd call it It's Tough to Be Bright.
True, very, very true. If you all want to do this real quick, look at guests, tonight's guests, left-hand side of the homepage, up at the top.
Oh, I'm not on my computer, I'm only on the phone.
Well, I can tell you.
I'm not very good at that. You just tell me what it is.
Yeah, I will. I'll do that. I want to get everybody over there, so go over to the left-hand side of the homepage, click on tonight's guests, look under John Barber's name, and you'll see photos. And click that open. And what it is, I just put together a little bit of fun. These are historic photos of, you know, one of the most popular restaurants, the number one nightclub.
Okay, that must
pictures.
Have moved so Frank's.
Yeah, and then we got to John's favorite, the oldest diner, eatery, restaurant in Hollywood, Musso and Frank.
And that's
so
it, Musso and Frank.
Go ahead.
That only two people had a credit card for Musso and Frank's, myself and Steven Spielberg.
Oh, how funny.
And I sent you a picture today. I took a picture of it. I have the Los Angeles Times did a huge article on Musso and Frank's, and they called it Mean Cuisine.
Yeah.
And the reason they call it Mean Cuisine, because one of the co-owners was a guy named Jesse, and I sent you the picture of him. He's bald and about 72, but he started as a busboy and ended up as one of the co-owners. He was literally in love with Sarita. He was in love with a Mexican girl who was a spitting image of Sarita, and she died. So when Sarita walked into the restaurant with me, my God, he couldn't get away from her. He couldn't get away from her. So, and we always had, if you walked in the front door, right in front of you would be the bar, where you get a seat at the bar, but if you turn to the right, that was the main dining room, and we always had the first table. It was always reserved for John and Sarita Barber. And
how nice.
One of Sarita's favorite movies was a movie called Gloria. Does that ring a bell with you?
No. Honestly,
well,
no.
It was with John Cassavetes' wife. I can't think
Jenna Rollins.
Yeah, Jenna Rollins.
How did I know that?
And
I don't know.
Yeah. What? And it's a gangster movie, but it's her running around with a 12-year-old boy that she's trying to protect because the bad guys have murdered the kid's father. So they end up going around together and sleeping together. I mean, it's just a wonderful movie.
She was a very underrated actress. Very good actress.
Oh, my God, was she good. Anyway, Sarita almost memorized every line of it. And we were sitting at the table, and this is something Sarita has never, ever done. I mean, sitting down at the table, she said, famous people come over, say hello to me just so they could look at Sarita because she was so beautiful. They would never come over just to say hello to me if I were by myself. And
you used her. John, you used her.
Anyway, one day, we're sitting there, And by us walks John Cassavetes with his agent. And he sits at the booth to our right. Sarita has never, ever, ever done this. She's been around the most famous people, and she didn't care. But she loved the movie Gloria. And she said to me, do you mind if I go and say hello to Mr. Cassavetes? And I said, no, not at all. Well, John had a curious texture of orange almost to his skin. She might have detected something about him. She said, I don't think he's well. So she got up, went over, shook his hand, and he wouldn't let go of her hand. So they chatted for a while. And then she came and sat down. And she was reciting lines from Gloria to him and really made his day. 5 days later, he died. He died.
Wow. That's timing. Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah. And just somehow Sarita felt that about him, you know. But it was a restaurant where even in the silent days, the writers and directors and the movie stars used to gather there to eat and drink at the bar.
Well, after the hour, you go look under your name at the photos, you'll see. Let me take our audience through them real quick. The first little group of pictures is the world-famous Brown Derby. Okay, there's a nice picture of the Brown Derby. It's right on the corner with traffic, and it's a black-and-white picture. And then we go inside, and you'll see pictures of stars in there, Clark Gable,
Carol
Lombard.
Well, you know the
Lombard.
Most famous thing about the Brown Derby and Vine Street? Was their grapefruit cake. They had a grapefruit cake. It was a cake with icing. It was the most delicious thing you ever ate, and that was the Brown Derby. And there were two of them. One of them was on Wilshire, and one was on Vine, and sadly, they both closed.
Well, this one looked like the hat, and they should never have let that go. Hollywood made a big mistake.
Oh, my God, no. It would be a classic. It would be a classic. Well, you know, somebody else, you know, some famous movie star should have taken it over and renamed it after himself or herself.
Whatever.
And
whatever.
Let that building remain because it was just one of a kind.
Hollywood blew it. They allowed the studios to sell off their back lots. You remember when the MGM back lot was sold and they had that huge auction in the 70s where they sold off all of the costumes from 50 years of films? Yeah. My God, they should have kept all of that and put it in warehouses, eventually put it in beautiful buildings and turned it into a theme park. They should have had people. It would have been hugely successful.
A friend of mine from Hollywood who moved up here on Convention Drive bought a casino and used to call me every Friday and Saturday to come down and keep her company. That was Debbie Reynolds. And she bought a lot of the clothes you're talking about. And just before she died, she sold them all for about $10 million.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Because they had come from movies. She had dresses from The Wizard of Oz and all kinds of stuff. Uh-huh. So anyway,
those costumes should have been in a beautiful building. People walk aisle after aisle after aisle and look at the movie. Look at the poster, look at the costumes from the film. They were stupid to sell all that off.
You know what is actually missing from Hollywood, truthfully, is a large, large museum about the entire history of films in Hollywood. There is no such thing.
Mm-mm.
There is no such thing.
And the Brown Derby's gone, and the movie lots are going. They're selling off MGM's back lot. Now I guess they're going to sell the rest of it. I don't know. I hear rumors.
And the only safe area now on Hollywood Boulevard is around the Chinese Theater. That's where Hollywood, you know, has
all the
there's a
handprints.
Theater right next to it, and that's where they do the Emmys or Grammys and Academy Awards and stuff like that.
Right.
But that's the only clean block on Hollywood Boulevard now.
That's disgusting. Let me just quickly do this, John, on the Brown Derby. There's a picture, you'll see it, a picture of Clark Gable and Carol Lombard eating in there.
Oh, wow.
Cary Grant and I can't name this gal. They're in there. Cary Grant and another woman. Desi and Lucy are in there. I got pictures of all these people. William Holden and Lucille Ball. She made one of her TV shows was about the Brown Derby, and she was actually, they made a set of it. But William Holden, you remember how he died?
Yes, as a matter of fact, that's what ended my friendship with Frank Sinatra.
What? All right, I'm sitting down.
Okay, as you know, I was Sinatra's private writer for 4.5 years.
Yeah.
He and you know, he was after me. I was making $350 a week as a critic. And he was after me to go on the road with him, and he would pay me $3,500 a week. And I said, no. And he said, why would you say no? You're going to become famous in America, and not just in Hollywood, and you'll be making $3,500 a week. And then he smiled and he said, and you're with me. A big grin on his face. And I said, I don't want to be away from my son. I said, my father abandoned me when I was sick. I wasn't six. I wasn't going to abandon myself. He almost started crying. And that's when he said to me, you and I have to do something together someday. And I told him what he should do is he should do an Italian Roots. And he says, what the fuck is an Italian Roots? I said, you remember the movie Conte che te goes back to Africa?
Yeah.
I said, well, you're not just a singer. You're a major cultural and political influencer in this country. And if you had not sung High Hopes, John Kennedy would have never been in the White House. So I said, what you should do is you should do an Italian Roots. And he said, well, how would you do that? I said, you know, no one has ever done a video autobiography. I mean, they have biographies of famous people. They have biographies of Einstein and Joe DiMaggio and people like that. But nobody has ever done an autobiography. You are one of the most important entertainers and political influencers in this country. You should do an autobiographical series about yourself, an hour a day for 5 days. The world would stop to watch it. And I said, he said, how would I do that? I said, you know, the first time I saw you, he said, when? I said, I was 17 years of age, and I had gone to Nevada to be a gambler, and I was in Lake Tahoe, and that was my first stop because the train had stopped, and I thought they had stopped the train because the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had asked them to because they were looking for John Paul. So I got off the train, and I went to Lake Tahoe. He really laughed. And I said, while I was there, I'm at the table and I'm gambling. I'm only 17, but I put on a fedora and this blue suit, so I looked like
funny.
Cattle.
Funny,
okay,
funny.
So everybody is looking toward me. And I think, oh, my God, did they know I'm only 17 and they're going to arrest me, they're going to kick me out. But then I noticed they were looking behind me. So I turned around and I said, guess who I saw? He said, who? I said, I saw you walking through the glass doors, arm in arm with Sam Giancana. He almost shit.
Ooh.
Are you kidding? Because at the time, now see, this was in the 50s, okay? I guess when that happened, when he walked in. Now in the 70s, he's trying to convince the Sand Hotels that he doesn't know people like Sam Giancana. So that's when I'm telling him the story. And he was beyond shocked. And what happened is the entire place stopped as Frank Sinatra walked arm in arm with Sam Giancana through the place. because Sam Junkin and Frank owned it. And that's why they were there. But, oh, I was going to say, why our friendship was lost. It was over William Holden, right? Is that what
yeah,
I said?
This is a shock to me.
Okay, so
yeah.
William Holden was one of his best friends.
Yeah.
And I was one of the best friends to the coroner, the Japanese coroner.
Noguchi,
Thomas Noguchi. As a matter of fact, I have a... I tried to keep him his job as the independent coroner of L.A. I have in my bedroom a painting by him as Fabi was painting. We were intensely, intensely close. I formed a committee, and when we would meet, there'd be 2,000 people meeting to have his job saved. Well, Sinatra was the one who got rid of him, and in getting rid of him, he got rid of me, and this is how it happened. One of his best friends was William Holden. And when William Holden died in his condominium in Santa Monica, he fell against a coffee table, cracked his head open, knocked out, and bled to death. And that's what the Los Angeles Times reported.
Right.
But that's not what the autopsy showed, Thomas Noguchi. Thomas Noguchi said that he was drunk. He listed the amount of alcohol that was in his body.
He fell and hit
his head on the corner of the table, lay unconscious on the ground, and bled to death.
Got it. Yeah.
Sinatra was so pissed at me because I was supporting Noguchi, he never spoke to me again.
Wow.
Never, ever spoke to me again over the fact that Thomas Noguchi revealed the truth about Bill Holden's death.
I even heard that when it came out, that that's what the findings were. I heard that.
That's exactly what the findings were, but that's not what the L.A. Times first reported.
No, I remember. I remember that.
It was just like an accident, that's all. But then when the coroner's report came out and the truth came out, Sinatra hit the fan. I mean, he just went crazy.
Well,
and he's the one that got rid of Noguchi. He organized a bunch of Hollywood stars to get rid of Thomas Noguchi. That's what he did. Yeah, and so it also ended his friendship with me. But I loved being with him for the 4.5 years I was with him. We were really, really close because I didn't care that he was Frank Sinatra. Didn't make any difference to me. And when he offered me $3,500 a week to be his opening act, I turned him down because I didn't want to leave my son. He couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it. But he loved when I said he should do an Italian Roots and that I would come down every weekend and I would interview him about his entire life and he would keep all the tapes. I would re-edit the tapes so that you never heard my questions so it would look like an autobiography. And I said, what will happen is you will have 5 1-hours. It would be the only autobiography ever done by a famous star or personality in America, and that would be you. And for an hour every night, for 5 nights, the world would stop to look at you. And
yeah,
he said, when can we get started? Well, I said, I'm working on something now, and I'll be done in about 2 weeks, because I don't think it's going to go anywhere. He said, well, I'm going to call you in 2 weeks. So in that 2-week period, I sold Real People.
So he called me, and
he said, when can we get started? And the Italian couldn't say. And I said, well, I don't know. He said, what do you mean you don't know? I said, I just sold Real People to Slaughter and NBC. So I'm going to be tied up doing that. So that was that. But he would call me out of nowhere and say, can you give me a joke or two for this meeting, or can you give me a joke or two for that meeting? Well, you know who used to do that? One of my very closest friends was Mort Lachman. The name sound familiar?
Yes.
He was Bob Hope's head writer for nearly 30 years.
Yeah.
He lived in the apartment next to me.
Uh-huh.
And he used to tell me that he would get phone calls in the middle of the night from Bob Hope changing planes in Duluth. And he'd say, can you give me a couple of jokes about Duluth? But that's what Bob Hope was like wherever he went. But yeah. I loved him. And then I got to meet Bob Hope. As a matter of fact, I was with Christopher. And Christopher was like the six-year-old Tiger Woods. He was on network television hitting golf balls. And we're in Bob Hope's dressing room, and there are about eight stars there. And one of them was Peter Falk, Columbo. He loved Christopher. He used to go to the driving range in Studio City, called him son, and would just sit there for hours watching him hit golf balls. So, anyway, Bob Hope was organizing his golf tournament in Palm Springs. So I rudely asked him. I shouldn't have done it, but it was against my better judgment. But Christopher was there, and I thought, you know, Christopher should be seen with these guys. So I said, Bob, is it okay if I play in the tournament and have as my partner Christopher? And people cheered. And he says, no, I only have movie stars who are adults or something like that. And then he says, somebody would have to die before you could get in. That's exactly what he said. I said, well, from the look of your friends, I won't have to wait long. Well, I got screamed. Bob Hope never spoke to me again.
That did it, huh? I've heard some pretty negative things about Bob Hope, and especially about Bing and Bob. You never know if they're true or not, though, so I don't go there with it.
Well, I must say I have the interview that Bob Hope said was the best interview he has ever done. And it briefly came about, he did a special on NBC that was just god-awful. I'm the critic. So I bombed it. And I get a call from the general manager of the station. He said, would you take a call from Bob Hope's lawyer? And I said, sure. And he said, because this guy's really hounding me. I said, well, yeah, I'll take a call. So the phone rings, and I pick it up, and I said, hello? And this voice says, what did I ever do to you? And kid, he called me kid. And I recognized the voice, and I said, bored me. Well, he got really quiet.
Wow.
And then I said, you know, when I reviewed you, you must have missed something. Because the road pictures with Bing Crosby were absolutely fabulous. Your radio show, this is Bob broadcasting from Fort Hood Hope. Sponsored by Pepsi, and I used to listen to all the time. I said, you were one of my biggest heroes, but in this special, I said that you've become the J. Edgar Hoover of humor because you're reading from idiot cards that we can see. So he spent an hour on the phone and started talking about money. And he said, you know, people think that I'm only interested in money. I'm not. He said, because, you know, I had to pay 90%. Do you know that? That in
90.
The 50s?
No.
Do you remember that at all?
No. 90%?
They had to pay 90%
Never
in
heard
the 50s of their earnings. You can research it.
I believe it, but that's stunning. Yeah.
He said, I thought burlesque was going to last forever, and it didn't. And I thought radio was going to last forever and didn't. I thought TV would last forever and didn't. Movies aren't going to last forever, but what lasts forever is the land that they're on. And he said, you know, what I did when I renegotiated my contracts with NBC, I never asked for money. I asked for land. And he said, do you know that you're sitting on land that I own? He owned half of Burbank, for Christ's sake. And so I said, and then he spent an hour talking to me about his life. The first, he wanted to be a dancer. The first joke that he had to tell, he never wanted to be a comedian. He wanted to be a dancer. He was forced to tell a joke. And it was something about a Scotch farmer who was getting married, and he insisted to his bride-to-be that they'd get married in the barnyard so the chickens could eat the rice. His very first joke, and he could remember it. So anyway, I said to him, I said, you know, Bob, or Mr. Hope, excuse me, but I must tell you something. This is a lot more interesting than your shows or your movies, which I love. The movie you did with Lucille Ball is the best movie you ever made and the best movie she ever made. But, you know, you should come on my show and talk about this. I have what he said is the best half hour ever done. It was done when I had a half hour show on Channel 13 KCOP in Los Angeles. You go to my site. And it was a Christmas show. He gave up going to Fort Ord to entertain the troops on Christmas to come to KCOP on La Brea to do this little half-hour show with me.
Really?
And he said it is by far the best interview he's ever done in his life. We're live, and we take phone calls. We didn't plan anything, and in comes a phone call from Bing Crosby. And they had the greatest chat about how they met. And Bing Crosby remembered the first girl singer. And Bob Hope remembered the first sponsor. And that's, they went off on each other because Crosby's only interested in girls. And Bob was only interested in money. So if you go to my site, www.johnbarbersworld.com, and look for the half hour with Bob Hope, you're going to be absolutely knocked out how unbelievably charming and naturally witty that man is. He did not need writers, even though he had the best.
Wow. Wow. Well, you know what? I'm saying wow, and I must include the simple fact that your memory is astonishing.
Well, you know, it is even astonishing to me. I can remember, you know, let me tell you, this is weird and I don't know why. You remember Reader's Digest?
Yes.
Do you remember that one page they had about words?
There was a page in there about words. It was a vocabulary kind of a page.
Was a page called Word Power.
Yeah.
And that was the only reason I bought the book, was to read that page. I don't know where it came from. But from the time I was a kid, 6 years of age, I don't know whether it was the love of the language, because I used to all these stories all the time and listen to them and read them, and it was language. I fell in love with words when I was 6 years of age. And the only reason I ever got Reader's Digest is for that one single page called Word Power. And I had
That's
no
fascinating.
Idea.
No, I get it. I get it. That's fascinating. Words are amazing.
Some people, you know, their hobby is gathering stamps or...
Sure. No,
whatever. My hobby was gathering words.
That's remarkable.
And I don't know where this love of language came from. There was nobody articulate in my house. My father was gone. My mother was in Buffalo with some drunk half the time.
An uncle.
Yeah. So, where did this fascination for words come from? I have no idea.
That's really
None
interesting.
None whatsoever.
Yeah, Reader's Digest. I remember
Digest,
that page.
That's the only reason I bought.
Okay, I got a little one to add. It's not as neat as that. But I used to, seriously, buy an occasional book that was a simple book of words and their definitions. And I'd read it. I thought it was fascinating, too. This is not a joke. So I had the same understanding and appreciation of the power of words. Yeah, they're amazing things. Nobody looks at words and definitions anymore. You don't teach vocabulary anymore. No, none
whatsoever. And I'm still fascinated. And it's the English language that fascinates me just so much. And I don't even know where it comes from. I literally have a love of the English language. And especially words, which I started to read as a kid. But when I was a kid, you'd be stunned at the books I read. Somerset Maugham, Guy de Maupassant, O. Henry. I read everything. Just read everything. A voracious reader. I just loved words.
Well, more power to you. And I still have some of my little vocabulary books around. I kept them. They're still keepers. I can open them up right now and be intrigued. So I get it. I get what you're saying. Let me just finish up this little thing. When you look under John's name, and John will look under it after the program, we covered Musso and Frank earlier a little bit, the Brown Derby, but the best night spot in Hollywood was Ciro's. And it was a restaurant, and it was an entertainment place, like a nightclub.
I don't remember that. I just remember the Crescendo.
The Crescendo is another one. Yeah.
Well, that was a major nightclub, and then they had, I think it was upstairs, it was called Mocambo.
The Mocambo.
Yes. And when Turner, Ike Turner's wife,
Tina,
split from him, what's her name? Famous singer. Tina Turner. When she split from him, the first place she performed was upstairs at the Crescendo. And Red Fox was their opening act. And there were only 17 people in the room. And it was one of the most thrilling nights I ever spent in a nightclub. Oh, and I got to tell you, just this is a sidebar thing. Because somebody sent me a story about Lena Horne. I met Lena Horne when I did the Dean Martin show. I did the Dean Martin show, I think, four times, and twice Lena Horne was there. She was very rigid. She was very strict. She wouldn't let anybody near her, you know, and she was quite beautiful. And she was the first black semi-movie star because she was in a lot of the MGM musical singing.
She lived in Santa Barbara, where I lived. She lived not far from me in Santa Barbara.
Yes, that's right. Anyway, when I was doing Real People, and we went to New York to do the Real People story about New York, she called me, and she said, I'm performing at a club here. I said, a big, big club. Would you come and see my show? And I said, well, I would be absolutely honored to come and see your show. So
nice.
What she did, it was a one-woman show where she just talked about her life a little bit. It was just so wonderful. And then she would sing a song about that part of her life. Oh, my God, it was just amazing. And so afterwards, she waved at me to come backstage into her dressing room, and she shooed everybody out except me. And she said she'd always liked me because she thought I was really funny and I should have been better known, and that she'd met me on the Dean Martin show. And I said, well, you know, you're more than a performer. Do you mind if I call you Lena? She said, that's my name. You're more than a performer. She said, what do you mean? I said, you're an artist. She said, well, what's the difference? And I said, intelligence. She grabbed my face and kissed me full on the lips. Full on the lips. She said, my God, that's the nicest, smartest thing anybody has ever said to me. So, that's
well, you were right where you needed to be with the right words, and they were the truth. So it just came naturally.
Well, I never expected that kind of thing, you know.
No, my God.
But she was absolutely wonderful.
Well, how nice. What another nice story. Wow. When you look at the pictures of Musso and Frank, I put a picture of Frank Sinatra and Lauren Bacall at one of the red and white checkered cloth table, whatever they were eating
that's
there.
That's wonderful.
So you'll see that, too. And the last picture is one of what they called their Musso and Frank birthday steaks. You have a birthday and make a big steak and whatever.
Well, alongside that, I took a photograph of the newspaper article. It's called Mean Cuisine. Guy's name is Jesse. I sent it. It was from my phone. I sent it to your email. So you can include that with what you have there. And again, I repeat, only two people had a credit card to Musso Frank, myself and Spielberg. And I got it because of Sarita, because Jesse, the busboy who became one of the owners, fell in love with my wife. And we got a credit card along with Steven Spielberg.
Well, I have the L.A. style cover. I've got that. I didn't get the picture of the article yet, so email it to me again, if you will.
Well, it's only a picture. I didn't email the article. I just emailed the picture that says
Mean Cuisine. Oh, the cover. I got that. Yeah.
You got it. Okay, all you need. Yeah. I didn't want to send you the article. You don't need the article.
But if you want the article,
I can send it.
Sure, if you think it's worth reading, send it. Whatever. That's fine.
Only you and I would be interested in it, so it's meaningless.
Well, I hope you enjoy the pictures of the restaurants, and you'll remember Ciro's as soon as you see the pictures.
Oh, my God, will I ever? I used to haunt the place, for God's sake.
Well, my grandfather was the chef at Ciro's.
I know. Isn't that wonderful?
It's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and here's another picture of Sinatra in Ciro's I put in there. I don't know why. Probably because he was holding his Academy Award at the table with some woman.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Well, you'll see it. It's there.
Oh, that's great. That is great. Anyway.
Yeah. Fun stuff. So.
I wanted to tell you a little story. We got a few minutes.
Yeah. We got about 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes. Go ahead.
Oh, I don't know that we'll be able to get this story done. Anyway, quickly, you know, I was in the hospital. I never complain about being in the hospital. And, of course, with an enlarged prostate, I had to have a catheter, okay?
Yeah.
To urinate.
Yeah.
And so I asked the doctor, I said, hey, do you guys have any 80-year-old nurses? I said, what do you mean, 80-year-old nurses? I said, listen, the nurse that comes in to catheterize me is 25, and she's very pretty. And when she grabs hold of my penis in the catheter, I'm not sure that the liquid that comes out is going to be urine.
All right. Got it. That's funny. An 80-year-old nurse.
Yeah,
my.
I need an 80-year-old nurse.
That's funny.
Okay.
There's I would imagine at the hospital, if you go in again, and you've been in a few times, word will get around that John's back.
Yeah, John's back. I just wanted to tell you something. You know, Donald Trump's the only businessman in the world who built a casino and lost money.
Isn't that the truth? Wow.
He's so creepy.
He's totally what a creep. All right, Johnny. Thank you. Wonderful hour.
Thank you.
Thanks to Sarita. Okay. You soon. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
One and only. And that those words never fit anybody any better than they fit John Barber. This is one of a kind. Truly a remarkable human being. Okay. That's it for the week. Let's see what happens. We'll be here through the weekend on the network, of course, and back with you live on Monday. And the website will keep putting out the news. It's all stuff worth a look. Well, not all of it. Most of it. You get a few ringers here and there. So enjoy, take care, prepare, and keep watch. Keep watching. Talk soon. Have a great weekend.